At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
On the program today, the week that was. Because, honestly, how much more do we need? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today. This one is the 3rd of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Big week this week, economy-wise. The Fed met. And we were thus treated to the not-so-random musings of one Jerome Powell. We got jobs this morning, too. So much to talk about, so little time. Catherine Rampell's at the Washington Post. Gina Smilek is at the New York Times. They're both on the phone. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you. We'll start with jobs. We'll do reverse chronological order. 150,000 new jobs last month, 3.9% on the rate, ticked up just a little bit. What's not to like about this?
I think in general, the headline numbers look pretty decent. You know, it's not too hot, not too cold, the whole Goldilocks thing that we love to hear about. There are some underlying signs of vulnerability in the economy, besides the fact that the unemployment rate ticked up a teeny bit. You also have the shrinking work week. So people aren't losing their jobs per se, but they are working fewer hours per week at the jobs that they have, which is generally not a great sign. And the other thing that I would point out is that almost every month this year, the numbers have been revised downward. So whatever the original headline number was that came out that we all wrote about on the first Friday of the month, the subsequent months, it got revised downward, which suggests maybe something kind of screwy is going on with the seasonal adjustment or something that makes the economy look a little bit stronger at first glance than it actually is.
But Gina, don't we sort of want things to, with those revisions, right, specifically, don't we want things to be not quite as hot as they were, say, a month ago when it was 300 and something thousand jobs?
Yeah, I think that the takeaway from sort of a Federal Reserve perspective is that this is kind of what they've been waiting for. You know, the numbers across the board, as Catherine mentioned, we saw a tick down in the work week. We saw a tick down in wage growth on a month over month basis. Those are the kinds of things the Fed has long been waiting to see. And I think we saw markets react sort of in line with that. We saw them being pretty happy with these numbers. And so I think the takeaway here from sort of a monetary policy interest rates perspective is maybe this means there's a little less work to do there.
What do you think, though, Catherine, about consumers in this economy? Because prices are still elevated, right? Inflation is down close to where the Fed wants it to be over the past 90 days. Prices still elevated. Consumers are a concern. Yes.
Well, it does look like they've run down a lot of their pandemic savings at this point, which is good and bad. It's good in the sense that it probably means they're going to exert less upward pressure on prices. On the downside, you know, like if there were, heaven forbid, a near-term recession, less of a nest egg to turn to as like a backup if people lose their jobs. Again, consumers doing pretty well all the same, but still some signs of weakness or vulnerability. If you look at credit card default rates or auto loan default rates, those have been ticking up. So in there, but there are some signs of stress.
Catherine, do me a favor and wiggle your microphone or something because you're breaking up a little bit, and we'll see if that makes it any better. But Gina, listen, let me ask you this. I'm going to play a piece of tape from Powell from this meeting. Jake, let's hit that first one, and then I'm going to come back to Gina.
We're going meeting by meeting. We're asking ourselves whether we've achieved a stance of policy that is sufficiently restrictive to bring inflation down to 2% over time.
He has been saying some version of that for a year, maybe more. And I guess I wonder two things. Number one, what's it like to sit in the room and have him say the same thing for a year and a half? And number two is, what more do you think he wants to see?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, it could be boring, except that it's not boring because we don't actually know what's going to happen next.
Says the Fed reporter who wrote a book on the Fed. But anyway.
But I will say there have been times in my Fed career when the Fed has been deeply boring, and this is not one of them, mostly because I think everything is so uncertain right now. You know, I think that we just had this blowout GDP report, you know, and then right after that, we have a nice slow jobs report. And so I think from their perspective, it's really tough to get a handle on what is actually happening in this economy, how effective their interest rate increases have actually been. And so I think that makes it really hard for them to be definitively like, we're done, or on the other side of it, definitively like, we're not done, you know. And so I think that there's some real questions. You know, markets pretty roundly think that the Fed is likely done with interest rate increases, but you know, this economy has surprised us over and over again. And so I think, you know, it's anybody's guess what happens over the next 6 months.
Well, Catherine, on that point of the markets think the Fed is done, so look, the markets took a year and a half to take Powell and the gang at their word that they were going to keep rates high and keep raising them, you know, in the recent past, as much as they need to. And I guess now, how much faith should we actually put in the markets, and do you have any?
Well, it was interesting. If you look at where markets think rates are going to go by the end of this year, they think there's virtually no chance that there's going to be another rate hike at the next meeting. And despite the fact, of course, that the Fed officials themselves have projected a rate increase. And when Powell was asked about that at the press conference, he kind of said, well, like, those projections are a little bit old at this point. I mean, he didn't say it in exactly those words, but he did seem to give credence to the fact that you shouldn't at least take the Fed at its word, because its word has to change as the data come in. If you look at where markets are now, besides the fact that they don't price in another rate hike by the end of this year, they do seem to suggest that we are at least as likely, if not more likely, to have rate cuts by March as we are to have a rate hike, although the baseline scenario seems to be you know, rates stay about where they are. So I don't know. I think both markets and the Fed are responding to these wild and wacky data that Gina was just talking about, and it's really hard to tell a clean story about them.
Gina, I don't want to get too far into the Kremlinology of this thing, but it did strike me at this meeting, watching Powell, and granted, I was watching on TV and you were in the room, he seemed a little weary, a little worn down after a year and a half, 2 years of this.
Yeah, wouldn't you be worn down?
I totally would be. I totally would be.
I think it's interesting. I do think that there are a couple of things going on there. You know, obviously we're going and asking him the same questions, and he's having to give variations of the same answers. I also think this time, though, he had a little bit of a tough messaging thing that was going on that I think probably came across as him just repeating himself.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Because he needed to avoid telling markets too definitively, like, oh, hey, we think things are going well and we think we're done. Because if he sounded too positive about that, then there was a chance that rates were just going to plummet, and then the Fed would not be done because it would turn out that markets moved in the opposite direction. And so I think he wanted to sound not too glum, but also not too happy. And I'm not sure that he nailed it, because actually rates have come down quite a bit since then. But I do think that was part of what was going on there.
Yeah, that's the whole financial conditions thing, which Sabri's going to talk about in a minute, actually in about 10 or 12 minutes. Gina Smalek of the New York Times and Catherine Rempel at the Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. On Friday, the Wall Street verdict is this: up for the day, up for the week. Details, numbers, you all know the drill. All right, a little bit more now on jobs, and for it, we go to the data, specifically the bit about wages. Average hourly earnings last month, which is the broadest measure of worker paychecks, was up 4.1% in October from a year earlier. It was 4.3% in September, by way of comparison, 4.8% a year ago. And as news goes, this is good for the Fed, not terrible, but also not great for workers. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman takes it from there.
You know what I used to see all the time, like a year ago, on signs outside fast food places, on billboards for big box stores? Signing bonus, offering several hundred dollars at least, plus a starting salary well above minimum wage. I'm not seeing that so much anymore.
Wage growth has fallen sharply.
Dean Baker is co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
We saw the annualized rate over the last 3 months is 3.2%. It's a little higher if you take over the last year, but it's clearly come down a lot.
Back in 2021, as employers scrambled to hire up, wage gains peaked around 6% a year for workers overall, 14% for service workers like bartenders and waiters. Now, says Baker,
the current rate of wage growth is less than what we had in 2018, 2019, when inflation was below the Fed's target. So I would think the Fed has to feel pretty good about this, that they've gotten wage growth down. You know, to my view, it's time for them to say mission accomplished.
Wait for it. Nah, don't. You might be waiting a while. Meanwhile, employers are noting a downward trend in wage expectations, even among the highest paid workers, says Jer Doyle at staffing firm Manpower Group.
The demands from candidates are a little bit more moderate. I spend a lot of time on the technology side of the business, and we've even seen that there. They're still extremely high, but definitely starting to come down.
One group for whom the good times are no longer rolling is low-paid service workers. Their wages were rising by double digits in 2021 and 22, says Dean Baker.
Doesn't mean they were doing great, but they were doing better. But that trend seems to have come to an end.
Now, wage growth for leisure and hospitality workers, for instance, is pretty close to that of workers overall, with pay up in October to an average of $19 an hour. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Should you miss something on the actual air, we've got a podcast. We won't judge you. Life gets in the way. We get it. Check it out, marketplace.org or the platform of your choice. Citigroup's got some news for its credit card customers, and by news, I kind of mean ultimatum, actually. Go paperless or get kicked off their online accounts. That is reporting from the Wall Street Journal this week. In fact, the number of credit card users overall, not just Citi, who've enrolled in paperless billing is up a lot, from a third to two-thirds since 2015, as companies have pressured their customers to go paperless. That will save those businesses on papers and postage, yes, and it is one more step away from hard copy to electronic in this digital age. Do spare a thought, though, for the paper business. Marketplace's Elizabeth Troval has that one.
How does a paper company adapt to the digital world? It's just as good of a question now as it was back in 2007, when a class of business students asked fictional paper salesman Michael Scott on The Office. He admits computers are valuable.
They are great for playing games and forwarding funny emails. But real business is done on paper. Okay? Write that down.
But the paper business is in flux these days. Demand for certain paper products is down, specifically in billing, says Matt Bruno with the National Paper Trade Association.
The overall trend, though, in the billing world is to move to paperless billing. And I think that's shifted our market.
Revenue for the U.S. paper mill industry declined 4% in the last 5 years, according to a report by IBISWorld. Firms are doing more business online. But Bruno has some Michael Scott-like optimism.
We've seen this rapid growth in areas like packaging, right? And so where one side falls down, another side goes up.
The side that's going up is because of all those online orders we've been putting in. Think about that mountain of cardboard boxes in the garage. Chris Tang is a supply chain management professor at UCLA.
The e-commerce is actually really creating a big consumption of paper right now.
Still, Tang says paper has its place.
For the legal documents, they still want to serve you the paper format.
Which harkens back to paper's historic role as a tool for record keeping, says Virginia Howell, who runs the Museum of Papermaking at Georgia Tech.
When you have a business that lasts 100 years, there are people who don't know, you know, how it was founded. Why are we doing the things that we do? Where did we spend that money?
That's the kind of paper trail that makes paper ubiquitous. Credit card statements, maybe not so much. I'm Elizabeth Trofall for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we have a whole team monitoring every ride.
Buckle up, everybody. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials, up 222 points today, 2/3 of 1%, 34,061 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ increased 184 points, about 1.4%, 13,478. The S&P 500 added 40 points. 0.9%, 43.58 there. For the week that was, the Dow jumped 5%, the NASDAQ surged 6.6%, S&P 500 ascended 5.8%. There is apparently a national day for everything, and today is National Sandwich Day. So how about some restaurants that sell sandwiches and their stocks? How about that? Restaurant Brands International, which operates Firehouse Subs, lost 1.9% today. Potbelly, the company behind Potbelly Sandwich Shop, jumped 7.25%. And if you're wondering why shops like Arby's, Panera, and Subway are missing from our list here, they are all owned by privately held companies. According, by the way, to a 2015 report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the most recent we could find, 47% of U.S. adults eat a sandwich on any given day. Sandwiches made with cold cuts are most common. Just a quarter of all sandwiches consumed is cold cuts. Burgers came in at second place at 17%. Point of personal privilege here. Hamburgers are not sandwiches. I will die on this hill. In third, sandwiches made with chicken, turkey, or other poultry at 12%. Let's move on. Bonds up. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
Big news! One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will be the first to admit that there's a lot that happens in this economy that people who are in and about it every day in the analytical sense, right, not just as participants in the economy, but in the analytical sense, we just kind of assume that people understand, and that obviously includes us. Rarely, we hope, but sometimes. Anyway, I talked about something known as financial conditions yesterday and whether the Federal Reserve might be able to count on those conditions to do some of its work for them. And then I was thinking this morning that we need a better explainer on it. Enter now Marketplace's Sabri Benishour.
Asking about financial conditions is really just asking how much breathing room there is in the economy. Like, if you don't have the cash you need right this second, how easy or hard is it to go borrow some? Carl Tannenbaum is chief economist at Northern Trust.
Many businesses obviously borrow from banks. Some go straight to the financial markets. Same thing for consumers. We use our credit cards. We get home mortgages.
If you can control that, the ability to go out and borrow, you control the economy. You can help it grow. You can slow it down. You can control inflation. But the Fed does not actually totally control financial conditions. It tries. It would probably love to, but it doesn't. Reality gets in the way.
At the moment, for example, bank lending standards have been relatively tight for most of this year in the wake of the banking crisis that we had last spring. And so it is quite a bit harder for firms and individuals to get bank credit than it was 12 months ago.
Fed didn't do that. And there's gas prices. They rise or fall, affecting people's budgets and willingness to borrow. Fed's got nothing to do with that either. Stock prices can rise or fall, making it easier or harder for some businesses to raise money. No Fed there. And long-term bond yields, these are what affect mortgages and car loans. They can rise or fall, and they are set by the bond market.
And then all of a sudden, you are either getting more restrictive, effective monetary policy in the system, even though the Fed hasn't necessarily acted.
Simon Harvey is head of FX analysis at Monex Europe and Monex Canada. One of the few things the Fed can control directly is short-term interest rates. But it can try to influence the markets that control long-term interest rates. It'll literally tell them that it will keep doing whatever it is doing now. That would affect pricing of long-term bonds. But sometimes markets don't listen because they don't buy it.
And this is the kind of the game that we have to play in financial markets, right?
If that sounds messy, that is because it is. And that's why Harvey says predicting where interest rates will end up when is as much an art as it is a science. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
School bus driver shortages have made some news this year, from late-night drop-offs in Jefferson County, Kentucky, to the Chicago public school system canceling yellow bus service for more than 5,500 general education students. In Framingham, Massachusetts, the school district only has about 75% of the bus drivers that it needs. But as Kara Young reports from WBUR, help could be on the way from a growing group of tech startups.
The Framingham School District outside of Boston is short about 20 bus drivers this year. Not enough drivers means not enough buses and not enough space for every student who needs a ride. This year, kids who live less than 2 miles from school have to walk. School leaders know this situation is not ideal, especially for young students.
I have a first grader and I can't imagine her walking, 1.8 miles to school. So I get it.
Lincoln Lynch IV is with Framingham Public Schools. He says the lack of bus service is more than just inconvenient. It can also lead to increased student absences, especially on early release days or when there's bad weather.
It's really the toughest part, knowing that, there are students that haven't come to school because we cannot transport them.
That's why Lynch and his team are trying to offer families some other solutions. In October, the school district signed a deal with a tech company that runs a carpool coordination platform called Carpool to School. The district pays the fees, so the program is free for families.
Parents can organize carpooling, their kids walking, taking public transit, biking together, utilizing our web and mobile apps.
Kimberly Moore is the co-founder and CEO of GoTogether, which runs the platform. She launched it in 2017, and now the company works with schools in 26 states.
GoTogether really is a national response to this national school bus driver shortage. Framingham is just one of many who are looking for options that can help families.
Over the last decade, more companies have been offering alternative school transportation solutions, including a rideshare-like app called Hop Skip Drive. Co-founder Joanna McFarland says she thought of the idea because she was a working parent who struggled to get her son to his after-school activities.
This is designed for kids by parents.
And now, because of the school bus driver shortage, the company works a lot more with school districts to transport kids to and from class. In some ways, Hop Skip Drive is similar to Uber or Lyft. Drivers can do this job in their free time, use their own cars, and choose rides that fit their schedule. But this rideshare app is a lot more kid-focused. It only hires drivers with caregiving experience, like healthcare workers and retired teachers. They go through rigorous background checks.
In addition to, you know, fingerprint-based background checks and driving record checks, we have a whole team monitoring every ride live in real time.
The company can see how fast drivers are going, or if they're driving aggressively. The school system foots the bill for the rides, so it's free to parents. Officials with the National Association for Pupil Transportation believe companies like this are going to be here for the long haul, especially since the shortage of bus drivers seems to be here to stay. Molly McGee Hewitt, the group's executive director, says it helps that transportation and rideshare apps are mainstream these days.
You know, we have gotten really used to using Ubers and Lyfts, and in a way, this is sort of meeting a need in the industry.
McGee Hewitt doesn't have concerns about any of these platforms right now, but says it is important to have uniform regulations for any rideshare service that transports students. She wants this option to be just as safe as the iconic yellow school bus. In Framingham, Massachusetts, I'm Carrie Young for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, saw this on Bloomberg, data from the transportation analytics firm Streetlight about how much we're all walking nowadays. The short answer is less than we were in the before times, way less. Average daily walking trips, that's the category, fell 36% nationally between 2019 and 2022. Every state in the contiguous 48 and every one of the 100 most populated metropolitan areas in this economy saw a walking drop of at least 20%. All right, we're going to go, but first we're going to give you your moment of economic context. It's another transportation item, also pandemic-related. The shipping behemoth Maersk said in its third-quarter earnings announcement today that revenues had been cut almost in half and that by year's end, about 10,000 people will have been laid off. It's a demand thing, as we're all buying less stuff, more services, once we got through that pandemic surge. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is vice president and general manager here at Marketplace World Headquarters. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see y'all on Monday, all right? This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.